A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
We are back with another episode of your favorite podcast. Welcome to The Wild Ones, the show where we chat about bike stuff. I'm Jimmy, and this week I'm joined by producer Emily and head nutritionist of EF Education Easy Post, Will Girling.
Hello.
Welcome to the podcast.
It's great to be here. Thank you very much.
This is our nutrition special, so we'll be diving into diet myths, bike nutrition, and what the pros are really doing. So Will's a good pal even of ours. He's been staying with us for a couple of days. In that time, we have fed him cheeseburgers, ice cream. We had fish and chips from the chip shop last night. Is that quite different to your usual diet?
No, it's the diet I have every day.
Do you think that there is a misconception about nutritionists that they have some superhuman willpower and only ever eat really healthy food? And an example of this I can give you is when I mentioned to pro bike mechanic Nick that Will was coming up to stay with me for a couple of days, he was just like, oh, get used to eating just healthy food. And I was like, oh, you have really misunderstood that Will is a performance nutritionist, and therefore performance nutritionists fuel.
Yeah, and eat fish and chips all the time, apparently. Yeah. No, I think it is definitely a misconception, but I like to eat, and I like to live my life and not feel like I'm constantly not having stuff. So
are you your size? Are you as tall as you are because you eat well?
Yeah, it's all the gold top milk I drink. That's what it is.
We have established from the last couple of days your new nickname as Gold Top.
Yes.
We should probably explain Will's appearance for the people who are just listening. You're a rather tall man, aren't you? 6 foot?
6 foot 4, yeah.
If you were to visualize an English Viking, or probably a Saxon, you would basically visualize Will Girling.
I will take that, yes, definitely.
6'4".
Yeah, 6'4", 110 kilos.
Absolute beefcake.
Yeah.
All of the bumps are in the right places.
Doesn't look like I should be working in cycling, that's for sure.
That is true.
You're an ex-powerlifter and probably one of the biggest men we've ever seen on a bike.
Yes, and actually at the Tour de France last year, I got mistaken for security.
I can believe that. Which
is hilarious. I was standing by the bus door and they were like, are you security or can we come on? And I was just like, yeah, just check.
I'm not security, but you also can't come on. So we actually met you, I can't even remember how many years ago, because you were cycling a lot and you were training for a world record, a cycling world record attempt.
That's right. Yes, I wanted to, in many levels, challenge myself, and I wanted to challenge stereotypes as well, because as you said, the amount of times I had people telling me you're a bit big to ride was crazy. And I wanted to do the length of Europe in the fastest time. I had a great team around me. I had you guys that was introduced to me, But yeah, obviously, sadly, that came to a shorter end of not happening due to an accident.
Yeah, ultimately, it didn't end up happening because you had an accident. We don't need to go into the detail of that. What I will remember till the day I die is I remember the first time I heard some of your power numbers, and I was just like disgusted that I knew someone that at the time your 60 minute power, so essentially your FTP, but like your actual 60 minute was about 400 watts.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
And I just remember being that is filth.
If only I was aero.
Or weighed 60 kilos.
Exactly.
Then it would be a different thing altogether.
It would be. I'd be living the Tour de France dream.
Right, okay, so let's kick off with some news. Firstly, US power meter brand Stages has apparently gone bust. They abruptly laid off their entire workforce last week, and it appears to have shut down all operations. It also emerged that they were in the process of being sued by Taiwanese bike brand Giant, which manufactured quite a few of their products. Giant filed this lawsuit in February over a £15.5 million worth of unpaid invoices and products. The shutdown seems to have come out of the blue for some, including their UK distributor Saddleback. Saddleback told RoadCC, "In truth, we aren't sure what's going on yet. Our brand manager is in contact, but we haven't been updated with anything as yet." They added that they'd cover any warranty claims for customers in the meantime, as they still have stock. So it begs the question, what has happened to Stages?
Well, one thing's for sure, they haven't paid their invoices, have they?
No. Yeah, I was reading a DC Rainmaker article on this, and he was saying the news has kind of been swirling around the industry for months now. Apparently they absolutely gutted their customer service team, and as a result, people who were customers who were potentially going through warranty claims or tech issues or whatever were getting in contact, and their response time was terrible, if at all they were getting a response. So
will they even get their warranties fulfilled then?
Well, Saddleback's saying that if you're a customer in the UK, you can do it through them because they have some stock currently, but there's presumably going to come a point where that isn't the case. A number of their key execs moved over to Giant as well, so it seems like it's in the background being gutted slowly.
Yeah,
but there's going to come a point. I mean, all of this hardware is related to software, and if there's no one to upkeep the software, then that's when the problem comes.
Seems a bit sneaky though that loads of executives are moving to Giant, and it's Giant saying that they're not paying their invoices.
Giant did announce in January 23 that they were acquiring a majority stake in Stages for $20 million. And then a few months later, it turned out that had fallen through. So it kind of feels like the executives moved across because something that was happening, they were going to merge, do some bits and pieces. Perhaps Giant started digging in a bit more and realized that it wasn't a very good purchase. Or perhaps if we want to look at it from the other end, perhaps they saw it was going down and they could just wait for it to crumble a bit more and get an even cheaper price for the business.
It's a popular product though, right? Like Stages power cranks.
I believe so. Or at one point it was. I mean, maybe that's the question. They sort of... they came through with their power meter in the crank, and they were almost one of the first sort of big players to do that. And they got in with Team Sky in the Froome and Wiggins era, so they became popular through that.
Yeah, I feel like I would imagine that they've dwindled over the last few years. As far as I'm aware, Shimano cranks that had power used to come by default with Stages on, and I don't think they do anymore. I think they now do their own power meters. SRAM obviously have their own power meters, which arrive on cranks. So it's probably been a lot harder for brands like Stages to be involved in this space because they have to be aftermarket. You know, Shimano and SRAM already have cranks that just arrive with power on if you're buying one with power on.
I'd probably do that as well. I'd probably just buy a bike. If I had the option of one coming with a power meter and not, I'd probably get the one with the power meter and just take the one it comes with.
Yeah.
Unless I'm seriously advised against using that one.
Yeah, and I think that's probably where they've been muscled out of it.
I feel like what Giant wants to do is acquire Stages so that Stages can become Giant's version of in-house power. Like, for example, Quark is for SRAM and whatever Shimano's is for Shimano.
Yeah, potentially, yeah. It's interesting that they obviously looked to buy it and then backed out, but it's a weird one from a customer's perspective. We were in the bike shop this morning, backyard bike shop, and James, the mechanic, he was saying he was waiting for something on order from them. So it's come very abruptly from an outsider perspective. It might have been rumbling on for a while, but it's just kind of like bang, all of a sudden happened.
On a side note, there's some other layoff news that's come through.
Yeah, Rafa closing their North America office effectively.
That's really interesting. That.
Yeah, this one, it was all over Facebook and it had so much interaction in it. I don't know whether that's just because it's Rafa or not. They've apparently laid off 6 out of their 8 staff and the other 2 have been relocated.
6 out of 8 staff specifically in North America.
In North America.
To be honest, I don't quite get why they would have an American office, because like they've had a London HQ since day one. I'm assuming the bulk of their stuff happens there. As we know, the industry is shriveling. So it makes sense to cut costs. And I guess it makes sense to cut costs of the American office because they probably, I'm assuming they're not core business functions because they will presumably be based in London.
Yeah, Bentonville, Arkansas is where it is. And apparently they have a clubhouse there. They just said it was down to consolidation efforts. I don't know what that really means.
It's just reducing costs.
They
probably built the American stuff because they wanted to feel like they're more present in America for all of the growth in the American space. And they probably got that now and don't need it anymore. So it's cut some costs.
Yep.
However, Colnago appeared to be immune to the effects of the cycling industry shrivel. This is the shrivel. So it's revealed that the Italian bike manufacturer turned over £47 million last year. That's an increase of 33% on 2022. So that is massive growth where we are at the minute. That's also with a £12 million profit, which also is massive in this space. That's a huge profit.
Yeah, it's significant because they're one of the few bike brands that are currently experiencing growth rather than decline, isn't it?
In fact, Colnago's growth has tripled since the brand was taken over by new UAE-based majority stakeholders in 2020. So what's their secret? Well, CEO Nicola Rosin reckons it's partly the Pogacar effect. They currently sponsor his UAE team Emirates squad and the women's UAE team ADQ. They also say it's their strategy of targeting the ultra high-end expensive drop bar bike market. Obviously, that's definitely fair. I would imagine Pinarello had a massive, massive, massive uplift as the whole Team Sky effect and Ineos following that.
Yeah.
And now Pogacar's the top boy. It makes sense that the bikes that he rides, everyone wants to ride as well.
Yeah, one of the things the CEO said is that they've thrived because they have relatively few SKUs, as in products. They stock relatively few products and they focused on that. So I think that is definitely a trap that businesses fell into during COVID. They bought big and they tried to order lots of stock because number one, it was doing well. And number two, there were delays. So it's kind of
they're getting all the stock too late as when the boom's already gone.
Yeah. So perhaps it appears that they've got around it well.
Well, it seems like a good acquisition for the new stakeholders, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Now we're going to throw it over to Will to answer some of our burning questions about life as a pro cycling nutritionist.
Ooh.
So first off, what are the biggest myths that people still believe when it comes to dieting and nutrition?
Well, I think one of the biggest myths easily is, or number one in this case would be, eating is cheating.
And by that you mean eating while on the bike?
Yeah, so like if you're on the bike, that if you're fueling on the bike, that you are cheating the gains that you're possibly going to get out of that ride and you could be getting more out of it by doing that.
I feel like it's a mentality that crosses over from other sports that might not go on as long and you can probably get away with. Although, I mean, potentially you would argue you still need to fuel those properly. But for example, if you're doing a 5K, you're not eating in between that. Or if you're playing a game of football, you might be having a quick swig of drink, but you're not regularly consuming food throughout that activity.
No, exactly. Like, I think anything under 90 minutes, you don't really need to fuel for. You know, it's more about what you're having in the lead up to that activity. Whereas if something's starting to go 2 hours or greater, or definitely over 3 or especially 4 hours, then, you know, you really need to be fueling on that ride to maximize what you're trying to do.
I was going to say, what's your opinion on fasted training?
I think it's overhyped. And I think that realistically, you're not going to get what you want out of it. And the majority of people that are riding their bikes are just riding their bikes to enjoy riding their bike or to have some form of training that they enjoy, to ride with friends or to have an activity or or event that they're working towards, but you're going to get always more out of that riding if you fuel for it and you can ride well, perform well, do the efforts that you need to do, etc.
Quite simply just enjoy it more.
Yeah, exactly.
Rather than end up in a hole and finish the ride and be like, oh, I feel like rubbish.
We've all done it though. You've gone out on a ride, it could be 2 hours, and you've decided to do it faster and you feel absolutely, you know, shocking at the end of it. And, you know, then you come back and you hit the fridge or whatever, and you kind of end up over consuming calories afterwards. You don't really perform the ride how you wanted to because you're struggling towards the end. You're not going to get the most bang for your buck.
You were on a TV show where there was a study comparing fasted versus sugar as fuel.
Yes, I was. Yeah.
For exercise.
Yeah. Historic moment. it was a New Year's Day special.
Oh, was it?
It was indeed, yes.
And I would assume that using sugar for fuel is going to have better performance results than doing it fasted. Was correct. That the result of the study?
It was. It was an incredible study. It was, yeah. But that's what we did. We just used table sugar compared to nothing, and you perform better with table sugar.
There we go. Definitely a myth then.
Easy DIY drink for at home.
I feel like when we talked about this yesterday, you mentioned that you had some experience of fasted training with pros and monitoring that and seeing.
Yeah, it gets used maybe a little bit more in the preseason, but even then we really rarely use it because when the factors that we've spoken about and then looking at the training week that they have, which can be 25 hours a week, something like this, such a huge amount of volume in their week that the potential risk, especially during winter when it's colder air, which can cause dry mouth and can increase your risk of upper respiratory tract infections, that having added stress of low carb training, which increases the cortisol response to the session, which further suppresses your immune system, just opens up more risk more frequently to infection.
Interesting.
So we don't want to risk infection and a rider then loses a week or 2 weeks of riding when we could just do it fed, or, you know, it doesn't mean they have to do 90 grams an hour. They could do, you know, 60.
Yep.
But it's going to be better for their recovery and they're going to perform better.
So my journalist brain is saying the headline here is faster training can make you sick.
Yeah. I mean, it could do for sure.
As could any training, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess so. Perhaps. but that's an interesting point. I've never heard that before about the potential risk of infection.
Yeah. I actually think it's really interesting because, you know, we have hung out a lot over the years, but since Emily and myself moved to the north, we were really busy with Atticus and then COVID, blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We ultimately haven't seen you in person and hung out for 4 years, which is shameful.
It is shocking.
But I actually have noticed a difference in how you approach nutrition now from before. And in that 4 years, you've basically been with, how many years have you been with EF now?
4 years.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
The thing that you talk, that I've heard you talk about more in this time than you ever have before is keeping people healthy.
Yeah.
And it makes sense because these are like super elite athletes that like part of the job is making sure they're fit, making sure they're healthy, making sure they can race, making sure they're not injured.
Yeah.
And you're part of that in the nutrition space is that focus.
Yeah, yeah. We've had the lowest amount of sickness in it currently. This year, we've had the lowest amount of sickness we've had in a long time. And yeah, it's crazy that, you know, sickness can ruin a whole preseason.
Yeah.
You know, you're in a build, and then you lose 2 weeks to sickness. Then you've had 2 weeks off the bike, essentially, with maybe some lower volume towards the end. And then that you've got to start all over again. And maybe actually you're racing, I don't know, Tour Down Under, which is already an early start to your season. Mm-hmm. Like it suddenly all just got a little bit ruined.
I want to caveat for normal people that not riding for 2 weeks doesn't mean that you're going to be back to zero. It's that for a professional cyclist, they are building and therefore it just knocks that build phase. But for normal people, being ill and taking 2 weeks off the bike is fine. It's not going to be a big deal.
Yeah, of course.
What else? What other myths have you got for us then?
Let's do number two. I guess number two would be sugar is the enemy.
That is probably the most talked about thing in the history of food over the last 20, 30 years is that sugar is devil.
Yeah, I think it's still getting thrown around, right? Like, you know, we go through all different cycles of diet, you know, high, like low fat used to be the thing, you know, and then obviously carbs and so on. But like sugar has consistently stayed there, being like sugar and insulin is the enemy. And I think it's all about, as with everything in nutrition, it's all about context of where that's happening in your day, what your week is looking like, what your training program looks like. And there is a space and a time for near enough every food in your week. And it's just about being sensible about managing when you have it and where you have it.
I feel like I see in the news a lot stuff about insulin resistance and the idea that our diets are so heavy in sugar and it's causing insulin resistance.
Yeah.
Are you going to get insulin resistance if you're doing lots of riding and eating lots of sugar?
Yeah. Can you still get, yes, you can still do exercise and still get insulin resistance, but exercise improves your insulin sensitivity overall in general.
Can I ask a pre-question to this? What is insulin resistance and why is it a bad thing?
Well, it'll be a case of that as you're bringing in sugar and then blood sugar rises, if you're then not able to release insulin, which is insulin resistance, that you don't release as much or what you need to be able to remove sugar from the blood, that sugar then stays in the blood for prolonged periods of time.
Right.
And with elevated blood sugar levels for prolonged periods of time, you start to then get other health issues that come with it.
So is the idea that if you eat lots of sugar, your insulin gets lazy and you end up with too much sugar in your blood and there's repercussions of that?
Yeah, I guess so.
Like, yeah, and potentially a precursor for diabetes and that kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly. And that's why, depending on the type of diabetes you have, you also need to take insulin because you need to give yourself that insulin to then put into the stream to enable you to remove that blood sugar from there.
Okay, so back to the question.
So with exercise, you're saying your insulin sensitivity increases, so that's a good thing.
Yeah, which is a good thing. But then there's periods of time to have sugar. You obviously need sugar or a form of glucose during exercise to maintain exercise, because we know that during exercise, we are using the sugar that's in the blood. And if you run out of that, you bonk, and that's where you have low blood sugar level.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that if you maintain blood glucose levels, that you're able to maintain exercise performance, which means that you are able to take on glucose in its many forms, which could be glucose. It could be maltodextrin, which is a chain of glucose molecules. It could be sugar, which is glucose mixed with fructose. So there's a number of ways to take it on. And there's a whole bunch of research, loads and loads and loads, that show that you can have honey, you can have just sugar, you can have, yes, a gel or, you know, a Lucozade. They all do the same thing and help with performance.
So honey is not necessarily a better or worse type of sugar than table sugar or a Jelly Baby?
No. It's a different format of it.
Yes.
It has different connotations of where it comes from. How you feel about it, I guess.
But in terms of your body, sugar is sugar.
Yeah. I don't know if in specific if there are additional properties to honey that may be beneficial to you, so I couldn't answer that. But if we're looking at it from just molecules of sugar, that it will do the same thing.
Yep.
There's also a phase then after exercise called the insulin independent phase, which is where the body, through the process of exercise, becomes significantly more accepting of blood of sugar, and it transports it through more efficiently and effectively without the specific aid of insulin. And it's called an insulin independent phase. It's where certain trains or transporters move to the muscle membrane wall because of exercise, and they draw it all on more easily. And that's a great time where you can have, you know, certain items that you may enjoy, the less micronutrient dense options, that you could have after a ride if that's what you want.
So as a normal person out on a ride, sugar is not an enemy. What should you be looking to take on? What quantities and when?
Yeah, I think as part of the whole picture was that we didn't mention is like whether you exercise or not, taking on sweets and Coke and whatever like this just casually through the day is going to bring blood sugar level up. And if you repeatedly do that over prolonged periods of time, you can open yourself up to potential added risk of insulin resistance. But if you exercise more, you reduce that risk. If you take it on specifically around exercise, it's then just being used to fulfill exercise.
Yeah.
And in terms of amounts and quantities, that I would say anything less than 90 minutes, you don't need to take anything on. If it's kind of 90 minutes to 2.5 hours, you could probably range between 40 to 60 grams of carbohydrate an hour. And then anything longer than, you know, 2.5, 3 hours, I'd probably start moving to 60 to 90 grams an hour.
Good to know.
I think myth number three, and it's something that we come across quite a lot, is that you will be faster if you're skinnier. That lighter is always better.
I would definitely fell into that trap back in the day when I was racing.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do though. Like, does it mean that if you're 10 kilos overweight, you don't need to lose that? I think maybe if that supports your goals or your health goals in particular, that maybe you should still lose that. But if you're at a healthy weight and you're searching for the elusive 4 or 5 watts per kilo, maybe it's worth a conversation both with your coach or the people at, you know, what you're aiming towards, that you don't necessarily need to lose another 3 kilos to help you achieve that.
And have you seen that in terms of the pros that you're working with?
Yeah, for sure. That, like, we look at the races they're going to be doing and some of the profiles they're going to be doing and the gradients that are happening over those and how many kilometers they're doing at those gradients. And you can weigh up that it's probably not going to actually be that worthwhile to lose some weight that, once again, because in a calorie deficit, you are still opening yourself up to potential infection and reduced recovery, and holding a kilo could be better. And especially for a lot of the younger riders that we work with, we've focused more on developing them as a rider than over focusing on getting them to their optimal body composition right now. Especially when they're like 19, 20, they're still developing as a person. And I think even for normal everyday people, they could still gain, rather than focusing all the time on trying to lose weight, they could actually just focus on fueling correctly for everything that they're doing, and they will gain significantly more watts.
Yeah, and recover quickly and therefore be able to train more, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Because it's interesting, I was asking you yesterday whether weigh-ins are still a regular thing within a team, and you were saying yes, because I've seen from, especially in the women's pro peloton, stories that have come out in the last sort of decade about the pressure to constantly lose weight and regular weigh-ins and weigh-ins being done around contract renewals and how that can create negative mindsets. Yeah. But you had a really good comeback to that.
Yeah. So, I mean, we don't do it around contracts.
Yeah,
I think
of course,
that does come with certain connotations of why you're doing that. But we do regular weigh-ins with the purpose of also having more information and data around the rider when we're getting like blood results. And if we see that maybe cortisol is going up and testosterone is going down, shows a sign of under recovery. Oh, that there's a trend, their weight's going down. Probably a case that there's, you know, a calorie deficit going on. Or seeing around peak performances as well, where they've performed really well. And then we have data to show that maybe they don't need to get lighter. It's just having a lot more information to be able to make more informed decisions. Because if a rider went through a full year of not weighing themselves at all, and then had performances at one point in the year that are really good and another point they're really rubbish, that you've then only got their literal ride data as the only factor to go, oh, okay, yeah, he did good here because of these reasons.
Yeah.
Do you think that technology and access to information has made it easier for teams to not have to focus on weight? So for example, I would imagine 20 years ago, I imagine you can do blood work continuously and you can monitor what that rider's heart rate is 24/7 and their blood sugar levels pretty much continuously and their power data and the heart rate. You've got so much access to information. It allows you to be much more informed about that. Actually, this person's a few kilos heavier than what we would have wanted them to have been 20 years ago, but it works.
Yeah, I think there's a lot more information in general about how to manage their training. I think there's a lot more strength and conditioning happening more consistently to help with bone density, to help with them being more of a complete rider. So that's also going to, you know, have a higher general level of muscle mass potentially and development of that. And we're seeing that as well, that races are faster than ever. Every race is becoming the fastest race that they've done.
Wild, isn't it?
Yeah. Breaks are taking longer to go than ever. And the pace is so much higher. And there's obviously a lot of data that's come from everything, a lot of progression in a lot of different areas that's enabling people, riders, to ride harder for longer. Another myth for us, which would be myth number four, is that people feel they need to have race day nutrition to perform the best they can, that they need to have gels and bars and sports commercial products to achieve the best performances they can do. And that's not necessarily the case.
I remember many, many, many years ago, and I was like, what shall I take when I go out on my rides? You were like, just get a block of...
Ready roll icing.
Yes. And I just had like a block of icing that you just take a little couple of chunks out of every now and again.
Well, yeah, you could get a block of icing. It's a few years ago now, but I did look at it recently. It's like 500 grams or something for a block of ready roll icing, which is just sugar. And you could divide that up into, I think it was something like 10 servings, and it was £1.50. And it's the same as like any bar or gel, ultimately, in many ways. As we were talking about with the sugar earlier,
yeah,
like that's super cheap. That's easy. Doesn't work that well in summer. does melt in your pocket. I found out that the hard way.
What about like electrolytes and carb drinks? There's surely no realistic solution that you can just get from your kitchen for something like that.
You mean like table salt
and some,
yeah, table sugar. Yeah, exactly. You can literally, and I did a video of this on my YouTube, but like, you can make your own DIY electrolyte drink if you know how to make concentrations. So hypertonic, being a very hydrating based mixture, is going to be a 5% solution or below, which described easily is anywhere between what, you know, if you had it around 4 grams of carbohydrate per 100 mils of your bottle. So if it's a 500, 600, whatever mil bottle, you just put that amount of sugar per 100 mils and you've got a hypertonic drink. You add 1 gram of salt, which is 400 milligrams of sodium, and you've got a hypertonic drink.
Does that not taste horrible though?
No, it doesn't. And if you actually, especially in summer, it'll taste really good.
You could add a bit of cordial or something like that.
Well, sugar-free cordial, why not? Yeah. You know, you can do it on the go. You can take, I mean, less so with the sugar tax now because they've made drinks a little bit lower in sugar. But I think Coke is still true to its name of having 30 or 35 grams of sugar in a can.
Yep.
You do that into a 500 ml bottle, top it up with water, and then put in either a gram of salt from a cafe, or if you take an electrolyte tabs with you, you could use that. And that becomes also then a hypertonic, isotonic drink.
Yeah. I think it's important to say that you're not poo-pooing pre-made sports nutrition, as in like it's convenient. It comes pre-packaged in the amounts that you potentially need, and therefore you can just grab it, stick it in your pocket, and it works.
Yeah. And presumably EF are using products like that.
Yeah.
Because it makes sense.
There's convenience there. However, the downside of it is that it's expensive, which doesn't work for everyone. And I can imagine, especially as a newbie, if you're turning up to a race or a sportive or even a weekend ride and you see everyone has it, you can assume that that is what you need.
Yeah.
Rather than other people are just doing it for convenience, or maybe they think it's what they need.
No.
For whatever reason. It's just, completely. You don't need it. It's convenient. You don't need it.
I think it's fit for purpose.
Yeah.
Like, and you mentioned quite right. So many people get into cycling because they want to do Ride London and do that 100-mile event. And, you know, if you're going to do an event, then you need to train and use the items you're going to use on that event. And
Makes sense.
Yeah, which is super important. It's worthwhile looking up the sponsor of your event as well, because it could be Morton, it could be Gatorade, and they're the things that are going to be given for free at some of the feed stations. So it might be worthwhile using some of their products so you know you're used to it and you like the taste of it, etc. And it agrees with you, because products can be identical in many ways, but you still don't like it because the texture, taste, viscosity, whatever is different. But I think if you're just riding to enjoy riding, have some saurine and ready roll icing. But marshmallows work great as well. Obviously, any kind of sweet that's low in fat, Skittles, Haribo, fruit pastels.
So whilst we're talking about homemade drinks, if I don't get enough salt, then I'm always cramping.
Ah, yes, that is myth number five, right? That if you are...
Do you like my link there?
Yeah, it was really good. Segue. Yeah, that you, if you are cramping and having issues with cramps, that it is sodium. And I think that has been sold so much. There's so many companies, not naming any, that their whole business model is built on sodium relates to cramping. And it really, the majority of the time, it is not sodium based.
Well, what is it then?
It is fatigue, typically, that you are not used to the level of ride that you're doing, that you are have worked harder or you've gone further or you're pushing harder than you've pushed, and then you cramp. And obviously that always comes around certain other things. If you are riding longer, the chances of dehydration is greater and the chances of lower sodium amounts is greater.
Yeah.
But it's more that you're not used to that level of volume or distance, more so than the fact that you've, because if you did that distance regularly, you would probably find that you would have sufficient amounts of hydration, sodium amounts and so on, and you'd be able to perform it regularly.
So when I go out in the summer and it's 35 degrees, which is never, and I get back from a ride and I'm absolutely caked in salt, if I cramped on that ride, it probably isn't because I didn't get enough salt. It's probably because I just did more than I can handle.
I would probably say it's a contributing factor, but if you are covered in salt, there's obviously, there's certain science that suggests that everybody has their own sodium loss rate. Some people are more of a sweaty salter than others. And we test that across the board for all EF riders to see who is more at risk than others. But it, just because they have a higher loss rate does not mean that they're always going to cramp. In fact, one of our riders with the lowest salt rate, one of our riders with the lowest sodium loss rate in the team has some of the most cramps. And we find that cramping is also individualized, that some people are more prone to it than others. And there's no rhyme or reason. It's just the case. So, you know, not to make people feel sad about it if they get lots of cramps, but like, you know, we have people in the thousands of milligrams per liter loss rate and they never cramp. But then we have people in a like 100 and something milligrams and they've cramped quite regularly.
So if you are one of those people who are cramping regularly, what potentially can you do?
I think you need to look at lots of factors. That there are other, so low carbohydrate status can impact your ability to have cramps.
So as in you haven't had enough carbs?
Yeah, you haven't had enough carbs. You don't have enough muscle glycogen, or you don't have enough carbohydrate in the ride, because that's going to impact fatigue and increase fatigue.
Right.
So the muscle will become more tired. Hydration status overall, generally if you are dehydrated, not including sodium, can affect it.
So actually just not drinking enough, excluding the fact of whether you're putting electrolytes in or not.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Obviously there need, you know, there is other factors of that, that you shouldn't just keep drinking loads and loads of water because you get hyponatremia where you dilute yourself. So that is a, just a warning to people not to drink tons of water suddenly.
Yeah.
But, and maybe your training program is just not adequate.
Could it even be something like bike fit? Could you be in a compromised position, which is putting too much fatigue on a muscle, for example?
Sure. Like think about TTs or something, like, or anything really. Like you get a different bike, you start using slightly different muscle groups or muscle groups slightly differently because the fit is different.
Yeah. And they those muscles haven't developed as much as the ones which allow you to typically ride for five hours.
Exactly. Or somebody, you know, I mentioned a TT, someone starts going on the skis and they're in that hunched over position, they start to ride in that position longer than they ever had, and they start to get cramps in like their adductor or hip flexor or something. It's just because they're not used to being in that position and working those muscle groups. It'd be the same if you went to the gym loads, you know, you get those DOMS that ache the next day, and then like you tense your calf and it's like suddenly cramps up.
Ping.
Yeah, ping.
Well, that I think that will actually surprise a lot of people. I think so many people just assume I need more salts, I need electrolytes, I need more salts, I need electrolytes.
Mm. What would happen if you took on too much salt?
So if you start to, I mean, this is the thing, right? That I think people have been so scaremongered into salt, sodium, that they then just whack the strongest electrolytes they can into drinks. But that changes osmolality of the drink, and it can then slow down that digestion process, and then can actually cause you to get stomach issues, GI distress, slow down. And in turn, that will also affect your performance, because if you slow down digestion, not only will you get stomach issues, but also you won't be able to perform as well.
Interesting.
So it's not, you just want to find a middle ground. If you generally have an all right amount of sodium across the board, that you should be fine.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Myth number six would be that there is one diet to rule them all, and in the darkness bind them. Lord of the Rings reference. No. But yeah, you referenced it the other day in the podcast that you did with your man, James.
James Jobber.
There we go. Yeah. And
well, he referenced you, I think.
He did, yes. Yeah, but he also referenced Asker's post that, you know, it's all these different types of diets and you guys put it up really nicely, but they all work from a calorie deficit and that's the ultimate be-all and end-all of achieving fat loss, which is very true if we look at it in that light.
I have in a previous life, and it's one of the things that we've always had great conversations about, is I historically used to have a massive interest in nutrition. I was going to study. I was going to drop out of working in my job once upon a time, and I was going to go back to university, and I was going to study to be a dietitian, and I didn't end up doing it. But I have this huge passion for nutrition, and something that I've always found so frustrating is exactly this, is that you'll come across someone, usually on social media, not always, and they'll be like, you have to be keto. It has changed my life. I'm basically Superman now. It's like, well, that might work for you, but that doesn't mean that it's appropriate for everyone.
Yeah.
And the thing that has always infuriated me more than anything about social media, and for whatever reason, it's usually targeted at women, but not always, it will be the idea of, do these three exercises to lose your arm fat.
Oh yeah.
Or do these three exercises to drop
lose that
fat
belly
on
fat.
Your belly.
Yeah.
And that isn't a thing. Doesn't work like that.
Not at all. You can't spot reduce.
So you're saying you can't target one specific area.
Well, yeah, ultimately it's not possible to diet or exercise in a way that loses fat in any particular method. Mm. Everyone's bodies lose fat in different ways and in different places. For me, the leanest I've ever been, I still had belly fat. I still had a bit of fat, and it was really frustrating because I wanted to be outrageously skinny. Glad that I no longer want to be that anymore because it was horrible. But my point is, for me, that is always there. There's nothing I can do about that. Mm-hmm. For other people, they have absolutely no belly fat, but they have like big legs or whatever, you know? It's just everyone's different. That's just something that happens. And my experience and knowledge suggests that it doesn't matter what diet you're on, go with whatever works for you, because the only way you'll lose weight is if you are in a calorie deficit.
Yeah, we were talking about this yesterday as well, and we were talking about, you know, there is no one diet that's going to make you lose weight over any other. And that's fine. So you can kind of just choose one. And if it works for you, fine. I guess the place that this becomes problematic is stuff like Instagram diet advice.
Yeah.
So, for example, you were talking about Instagram, whether they're dietitians or whether they're just fit people that have a following and they talk about what they eat. And a lot of it tends to be bordering on disordered eating, but they've 100%. Lost weight and therefore their diet is messiah or whatever.
Yeah, I think the best diet overall, whether it's actually for fat loss or not in general, is that it's the diet that is the most sustainable one for you, right? The one that you can consistently do every day, every week, and enjoy. That is the most realistic diet that you can do. And if that does end up being keto, great, go enjoy yourself. You know, but I'll have my cake and I will eat it as well.
And, excellent delivery, I like that.
but like, you know, and you know, it helps a lot of people. There is great research for keto and epilepsy and things like this, right? But I think it can also be a great way for disordered eating to create barriers to say, very easily say, I'm not going to eat that food.
Yep.
And now if I say, I'm vegan or I'm keto, it's more accepted to say that. And then suddenly you don't have to eat all these other foods.
Yep.
And that can be one journey that someone goes down. And I think it's also a case of, we were talking about Eddie Abui or whatever, who's got I checked it the other day, it's 3.1 million followers now. I checked, looked at it 2 or 3 weeks ago, it's 2 million. And he's just exploding. And it's all horrible, terrible advice. He just goes around shaming every single food that you could possibly think of, but then goes home and has one or two meals a day and it's just eggs and bone broth.
Mm.
Suggests that this is the best way to live, which is, absolute trash, really.
As someone that once upon a time pretty much lived on tomato soup with frozen peas, living on a diet that is as restricted as eggs and bone broth is going to be absolutely bloody hideous.
The biggest thing is it's not sustainable, surely. It's an unhealthy way to lose weight because you're cutting out so many food groups and nutrients, but also you're not doing that forever. So you're losing the weight and then you're coming off that diet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hopefully, because otherwise you're probably going to have health issues. And then you're just going to put it back on because you haven't created a sustainable way to live and eat.
Well, exactly. And that's it's like the reverse slim fast diet, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, I'm not getting shakes anymore, but what I'm going to have instead is just meat. But then you're doing it because you want to lose weight, and inevitably you'll then stop doing that because you want to have bread or pasta or whatever, or just have a normal life. And you haven't had any education. You haven't learned anything about nutrition and how to manage it around your diet, your lifestyle, your exercise. So then you just go back to the habits you had before and gain that weight back, you know?
One of the, in my opinion, the current fad diet, which I guess I don't want to prime you, but I just have by calling it a fad diet. What is your opinion on intermittent fasting?
Well, it's not a diet overall. Mm-hmm. It's a protocol of how you eat, because it's not actually dictating the food that you have, but how you're having it. But ultimately, I mean, how many years did we just hear about don't skip breakfast or it's ultimately just people skipping breakfast. That's what intermittent fasting is, isn't it?
Yeah.
They're having lunch and then they're having dinner.
Well, there seems to be two approaches. There's the one where people eat for a small window in a day.
Yeah.
And there's the other one where people just fast for 3 days.
Yeah, yeah.
And then eat normal for 4 or whatever it is.
It's the idea, I mean, there's certain principles about it, which is as to why it's come around. One is that it helps with inflammation and something called autophagy and cell detoxification, but it doesn't do that any more than if you just did a calorie deficit. It's kind of pointless. There's then also research to show that by skipping breakfast and doing intermittent fasting, that the meals that you have later in the day are actually bigger and you eat more because you're more hungry. Mm-hmm. So then you don't create a calorie deficit anyway, unless you're then tracking your food and actually monitoring how much you're having.
I think the interesting thing with a lot of the fad diets that have come through and will always come through, it seems like there is some form of scientific studies that correctly identify certain diets or protocols as healthy for a particular niche thing. Like some of these diets are good. Like you mentioned, was it keto is really good for in some scenarios is almost a prescription for people with
epilepsy. Yeah, yeah. And type 2 diabetes as well. I mean,
and a lot of the time these diets are grounded in some kind of science for a purpose.
Yeah,
for example, I've got psoriasis, and I remember many, many years ago, there was loads of studies about acidic foods having an impact on psoriasis.
Yeah, yeah.
And I dabbled and played around with it, and I did find that to be true for me.
Red meat and...
Sorry?
Red meat and eggs can be one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's quite often science that does back these diets, but then it seems that then it gets latched on into the world of social media marketing. Atkins is a great example of it. There are examples of, or scientific examples where an Atkins diet, which is a really high fat diet, low carb, is that right?
Yeah, and high meat. Yeah.
I'm sure there are cases where that has been proven to be useful in some scenarios, but it isn't necessarily good for everyone and for health in general.
Yeah, for sure. It's like kind of been, I was saying that yesterday, I think it's been rebranded as the carnivore diet or whatever now, really, yeah. hasn't it? Because it's the same philosophies of just eating lots of meat, not having carbohydrates, and just focusing around that. I think any diet that focuses on excluding food groups then also gives poor relationships with food, because now you're denying yourself things. Mm. And it's like any old thing, you know, you're at school and you're told not to laugh, and it becomes suddenly really hard not to laugh.
Yeah.
Like it's like that with food. If someone tells you you can't have this food anymore, you suddenly start to crave that food. Oh, I really want that food. And when you come back to it, it's never, oh, I'll just have that one slice. It's like, oh, I'll fucking have a whole loaf.
I guess part of the problem is, to lose weight, you have to be in a calorie deficit. Therefore, yep. you do have to not eat something.
Correct. You can just do smaller amounts.
Yeah. Well, like, obviously, I understand how to lose weight in that method. So arguably, it is still excluding, but it's excluding everything to an extent. But I guess the point of this is that to lose weight, you need to be in a calorie deficit. But that doesn't mean you can't have a little bit of cake if it's appropriate for where you are in that day.
I think the problem is, and I think the reason that these fad diets get traction, is losing weight's incredibly hard.
It is.
We're talking
yeah.
about losing weight here. I'm not really a massive advocate for, you know, just talking about losing weight. But the problem is that this information exists whether we like it or not. So having Will here, who is a qualified nutritionist and has a very level head when it comes to these things, I think it's a good thing to ask questions about
yeah.
how to do it healthily, physically and healthily, mentally.
Yeah. I think that some of the biggest things is, obviously it is sensationalist. It is, you know, like this Eddie guy or whatever. It's like, it's easy for those things to blow up because it's so crazy. It's so, you know, off, you know, out of the box kind of thing.
Extreme, isn't it?
Yeah. Exactly, extreme. And it's also easy to fall into something like that, because if you're told not to have something, it becomes quite easy to follow it yes. in a sense, because you're just saying, I'm not having it anymore.
Yeah.
Which is like, I'm going to go on a no sugar diet or whatever it is. Whereas it's harder to just generally reduce everything.
Yes.
And this is why, you know, pretty much, I would say actually every client that comes and works with myself and my team and nutritionists, is that it is founded in wanting knowledge. Everybody just wants to know how to eat in relation to the activity and the lives that they lead. And that's the biggest thing with these diets as well. And especially within, I guess, the scene that we're talking in, mainly cycling or endurance sport, is that all these diets work in a general way for whether it's fat loss or not, but then to add in extra facets of, actually, I also want to ride my bike 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 hours a week and still perform and not lose power and not mainly power, I guess, on the bike, is a challenge, and not feel rubbish whilst doing it. Like, you still want to get on the bike and enjoy riding your bike, not feel like you're empty every single time you do it.
Yeah, I think one of the mistakes I've made in the past where I have attempted to lose some weight is I've looked at exercise as the source of that loss of weight.
Yeah.
And then I ended up under-eating whilst riding, having horrible times on the bike.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it really puts you off. Or just running or whatever exercise.
Yeah.
And then it would put me off wanting to do it. Whereas I think probably how I would approach it now is, you get my deficits on non-activity days.
Yeah.
So that when I am exercising, I'm fueling that exercise, I'm having a good time on the bike, I'm enjoying myself, I'm wanting to be out on the bike because
yeah.
I get to have a few sweeties.
Exactly. Yeah, there's many ways to skin a cat, as they say.
Do you still work with regular clients, Will?
I do still work with regular clients, yeah.
If people want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
They can head down to my website, which is willgirling.com. Really simple. There's an inquiry link there. You can just press on that and then just reach out to us. And I'll have a chat with you, sit down, we'll talk through it all and see how we can help you, really.
And if you're looking for free advice, I would recommend going to Will's YouTube channel, because you did put out some videos at some point. You've also done stuff in the past with Francis. So.
Yes, there's a bunch on Francis's page that you can find. I think if you type in nutrition to his channel, you can find a bunch of them.
Yeah.
But I did a whole series of different ones about riding, whether it's on your turbo, Zwift racing, carb loading for your event, how to do a calorie deficit, a whole bunch. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I haven't updated it because the science is still the same at the moment. So
can we talk a little bit about EF?
Yes, let's do it. Yeah.
So what does an EF rider typically eat in a day?
Well, that comes under the different, I guess, caveats of what are they doing and where are they?
Of course, yes.
Yeah, it's one of those things that people will just have a curiosity about.
Yeah.
So we all understand it's not advice. This isn't a recommendation of what a normal person should be doing, but it's just interesting.
Presumably everyone's slightly different as well, but you're the head nutritionist, so you're kind of devising their menu for a day during these grand tours on stages and rest days. What sort of quantities, what sort of food are they eating in what sort of quantities?
Yes. So, I mean, it's interesting because you said like it's not advice, but I remember there was that post that came out. It's 2018. Froomey won the Giro, won that crazy stay. I think stage 18, went off the front, did like some monster win. And I remember they put some photos of his meals in the lead up to that. And it was just like eggs and avocado or something. And like everybody's like, fasting's a thing to do.
Right, yeah.
And then like everybody started doing it and wondering, oh, they're going really crap. I think the spectrum's really broad, but like if they're at a grand tour or one day race, their intakes will range between 4,000 calories maybe to like 7,500 calories a day.
Okay.
So it's a massive spectrum, especially on a one day race or a queen stage on a grand tour. 7,000 calories is probably going to be very likely. They're going to have...
What does that look like in terms of quantities of food? Is that all meals or is it supplemented with...
Yeah, so stuff? Like what it might look like. So breakfast might be several slices of bread, a big plate of rice, a 3-egg omelette, a glass of fruit juice, a banana, some maple syrup or honey.
Singing to my heart.
Every meal solved. They'd have that. And then they might have a snack just before the race starts because it might start about 3 or 4 hours later.
What's a snack?
Could be a piece of fruit. Could be one of the rice cakes that the Swaneers made. Could be a race bit of food.
Packeted race.
Yeah, like a bar stuff. Something that, you know, the AMAX bars that we're sponsored by are actually really enjoyable. They've got a nougat one, which tastes like nougat. So
you've got to say that though. Even if say you don't, you've got to say that.
I know, exactly. But like, I do really like nougat, so I will happily have that.
Yeah.
And then obviously race, they'll fuel at minimum 90 grams an hour as our recommendation, but could go up to 120 grams an hour.
And are they taking that on through bottles or gels or?
All of them. So they'll do it through bottles, gels, and bars.
Right.
So are bottles nearly always carb drink bottles?
We do have water as well in there. Yeah. So it's a mixture. It depends on the day, depends what we're doing.
But what I mean is, are there some bottles that are just water bottles?
Yes.
Right, okay. Yeah.
I designed a system that's very much based upon heat and humidity for the team. So that dictates how we do things.
Right. Okay, cool.
And seeing as it's just me, it makes it a lot easier across the board as well to do it that way rather than me individually planning every day.
Mm-hmm.
Post-race, they'll get a recovery shake and some cherry juice at the line. Might have some Haribo there. And then they'll go back to the bus.
Cherry juice?
Yeah, so there's...
Specifically a cherry juice?
Specifically, yeah. It's a tart cherry juice or Montmorency cherries.
Right.
And these have really high anti-inflammatory properties, which have been shown to aid in muscle recovery and reductions in muscle inflammation.
Okay, cool.
That'll be the next big thing, Will. You heard it here first, cherry juice.
Cherry juice is coming.
And then they'll have that. They'll get to the bus and there'll be a spread on the bus. The recommendations that I give them is to have a bunch of really high GI-based carbohydrates.
What sort of stuff's in the spread?
So there will be Haribo there. There will be some sweets. There'll be some fruit juice as well, and some fruits. There'll also be a bunch of cereals, breads, pasta, rice, some condiments and sauces, maybe a dessert that the chef has made and it's also been put on the bus. They'll have that initial meal, they'll shower, then they'll have another meal, which could be a more of a proper meal. So that'll be the rice, the chicken, something like this. And then depending on the day, if it is a high day or what's coming the next day, mm-hmm. I'll get them to have another snack or meal every hour for another 2 hours after that. Oh, so that's a brilliant. Total of 4 hours, four meals. And then they'll have dinner and maybe some other snacks in there.
Do you care that much about protein?
Yes, we do. But it's very easy to get in with that amount of food.
Volume, yeah.
Yeah.
Because presumably, because a lot of these riders are on the smaller scale as well, you know, they're not bodybuilders. Yes, they need a good amount of protein, but it's not like like they don't need anywhere near as much protein as you do, for example.
No, exactly. Yeah, okay. If anything, it's actually a challenge sometimes to maybe keep it on the lower side.
Right.
Because, you know, 2 grams per kilogram body weight would be a general recommendation, let's say, for a high exercising individual, mm-hmm. And a bit of a minimum target. But you start adding in pasta, which has quite a lot of incidental protein within it. It's not a complete protein, but it still has some in. Mm-hmm. And you eat the amount that they eat, suddenly it's like starting to come up higher and higher. Like you said, only being 60, 70 kilos, it's not a huge amount of protein they need.
So what about rest days? How do they differ? And I guess there's two things. There's a Grand Tour rest day and there's just like chill days in a normal training week.
I think I would do similar on both, or would recommend them to do similar on both, is where we really focus on a lot of vegetables, a lot of micronutrient density, especially during Grand Tour. They're constantly having just to pack away so much carbohydrate that it can be very monotonous, and they like it plain quite a lot. They don't really like strong flavors because they've just got to eat so much of it. Mm-hmm. So on those rest days, we really push that, you know, colors and fibrous foods and things like this, unless they're following a low fiber diet.
Right.
Sorry for those guys.
Interesting. And how much are the riders involved in that? Are you micromanaging all of their meals, or is there some sort of leeway? Do you manage some more than others? How does that work?
Yeah, that ranges as well. So we have, you know, a rider that I've been working with and doing completely everything planned for him for 5 months now. And
so literally like everything.
Everything that he had and was eating, and every meal I planned absolutely everything for him, the amounts of it and so on.
And is that because he needed extra help, or is that because he was a focus for the team or somewhere in
between? Yeah, it's a focus for him, that it's part of his desire as well, but it's also some of the team's desire.
Yeah.
But then as it is just myself within the team, it's not possible to deliver that to every rider. Mm-hmm. And then there's kind of a range of how we do it, where I give macronutrient targets for just the day. I do a lot of education focus with the riders. I really try to show them how to do things, because an empowered rider is going to be a more intelligent rider.
Yep.
And they're going to be able to then manage things also themselves. If they understand how something works, and I'm, you know, I've planned it, but then something's changed, they've burnt more, they've burnt less, or whatever else. Or maybe the choices available, because it's at a race hotel that we don't have a chef at, they're able to make more informed decisions. And I think a smarter rider and a team of smarter riders will be a better team.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. Are they allowed to drink alcohol?
Yes, they are. It depends when. And so in a Grand Tour, they have had alcohol before. If we win, we definitely have some. They'll have a glass of Prosecco. Not every rider, though. Some riders decide not to partake. But normally they will have maybe a small glass of Prosecco or something like this.
And what's that going to do to them?
No, one glass will do nothing. But I think as you start to take more glasses, then you start to impair recovery. Sleep gets impaired. And obviously during a race like that, you need everything you can.
Can I ask a personal question?
Sure.
So most people by now know I like a glass of red wine.
Yeah.
And I maybe have like a bottle of wine a week. So I have like a bottle of wine over like a couple of days on like Friday,
don't lie,
Saturday.
I've seen you the last couple of days.
Yeah, but because you're here. You're the instigator.
Yeah. Sure,
you're the problem. So say, for example, you know, I'm doing some training. I'm trying to get myself a bit fitter, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I do a session, and then a couple of hours later, I'm like, oh, I'm going to have a glass of wine.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of people that would go, don't have the glass of wine because it's going to ruin all of the benefits that you've gained from that session.
You have lost all your gains.
Is that true or is that not true?
No, it's not true.
Oh, excellent.
No, that's every Fantastic. Day now, yeah.
That is probably the most important thing that everyone wants to know from this podcast.
One glass of anything is not going to change the outcome of that ride.
Oh, wait. Okay, so what if it's maybe three?
that's where it starts to... So as we increase alcohol consumption, we do a few different things. We will reduce your ability to stimulate a process called muscle protein synthesis, which is the recovery process of the muscles that you've done. So you've damaged muscles in the ride. As we increase alcohol, we will reduce that effect. Mm-hmm. So you may not recover as well. It will impact sleep, which will also then impair your ability to recover. It will increase your appetite. So any potential diet or something that you're doing, you may be less likely to stick to.
Yep.
And it also impaired decision-making that goes with that. So not only are you feeling more hungry, you're more likely then not to stick to it just because you're like, I don't want to.
Yeah.
So there are a few factors there. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, that's cleared it up wonderfully. I can stick to having a glass of wine or two without it causing any issues.
Exactly.
You just said about sleep there, and it made me think about caffeine as well. Are you using caffeine during races, rides, and then how are you managing that in terms of not impacting sleep?
Yes, we do use caffeine. We do have caffeine gels. We have caffeine tablets and chewing gum. Yes, there's a lot of some really great research on caffeine chewing gum, and we tend to use that a lot around TTs. And that's because the absorption of the caffeine from chewing gum format absorbs quicker. It peaks in like 15 minutes or so in the blood. Whereas if you take a tablet or coffee, it will take around an hour to peak. So you've got a longer wait time till it's at that peak point. And also with chewing gum, it exits the system quicker than a tablet or coffee will. Wow. So it's definitely a better choice, I think, for a caffeine option. Not unless you're doing a really long event.
Again, the caveat for that is professional cyclists, not normal people. Please, people, don't go out and buy yourself caffeine chewing gum. You don't need it. Just have a coffee before you go out.
Exactly.
On the topic of chewing gum, though, I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but it's relevant. We had an email from a man called Jonathan who lives in Perth, Australia, and he is a retired dentist. And he basically said that in a lot of our videos, we're talking about, you know, service station cuisine, lots of sugary stuff,
and
he wanted to make a point on our oral health that if you're eating lots of sweet stuff, especially when you're dehydrated, you've got a reduced saliva, and therefore the sugar sticks around on your teeth and it can cause damage to your teeth. So rinse with water and or use chewing gum, and it can help produce saliva, which will get rid of the stickiness and avoid the stickiest sweets if you can.
Interesting. I was going to mention about like dental health when we were talking about the different choices of carbohydrates and, you know, is sugar fine? Because the maltodextrins and the commercial products will still do the same things to your teeth as just doing sugar as well. Yeah. So like, it doesn't matter what choice you make in that realm, that it will still all affect your teeth. So follow that advice.
Yeah. So a clean bidden of water and swill it around and wash it down is going to protect your teeth, apparently.
Or perhaps brush your teeth when you get home.
Yeah, perhaps. But if you're out on a long day, then it's potentially a long time where it's being sat on.
Take that toothbrush with you.
Shall we? We've been talking for a while now. Shall we finish off with some listeners' questions?
Yes, please.
Okay, first question from Jesper in Denmark. I like to do 100 to 200 kilometer gravel rides, but I struggle to eat enough on the bike. I found if I eat serious amounts the day before, I ride better. I also get up early to eat before I set off. I do eat some gels while riding, but my cheap mind can't help thinking that I might as well just eat Snickers or add some sugar to one of my bottles. What should I be eating on the bike? And are gels, bars and whatnot better than the stuff I shoveled down my neck at the movies? So I guess we've kind of talked about this already.
It's as if it's, that's why one of these are myths, you know?
Like, yeah. You mentioned Snickers there. Should you be, you know, chocolate bars and that kind of thing versus pure sugar in sort of Skittles or Haribo?
That's where we end up on this kind of spectrum of like choices to make on the bike.
Yeah.
Ideally, if we're really focusing on performance and making sure that it's going into the bloodstream as easily as possible, and you're reducing risk of stomach issues, that we want the items to be low fat. If they're low in fat and low in fiber, they're not going to slow down digestion, and you're going to enable yourself to perform and use that item quicker. But if you're doing really long rides and they're lower in intensity, then there is slightly more scope to have items like that. It just means though that it will eat into your calories more for the day. So if you had a like Velo Forte, for instance, their biscotti bars or whatever are really high in fat, and if you did a whole ride fueled with those, you would end up having a copious amount of fat for your day just from ride food.
Right.
I feel like a question we get a lot is, you know, I don't like sugary stuff and I can't manage to make myself eat that. So what do I do? And it's kind of like, you know, if the optimum is you only eat sugar because of this and that and the other, if in reality it makes you feel better to just carry a sandwich as well and eat a sandwich and it gets you through your ride from a mental perspective, then fine.
There's nothing wrong with a jam sandwich and taking a jam sandwich with you. I mean, for this guy in particular, if you're doing 200K, it's quite a long ride. And some of the biggest issues we see maybe is just palate fatigue. If you're having the same thing, same flavor consistently over 6-15 hours, like you're going to get bored of it. And then you also get something like oral tolerance failure, where you can just start to feel sick and get gag reflex just from having the same thing continuously. So you want palate cleansers and things that are going to change that. Citric and zesty based flavors are great palate cleansers.
Interesting.
So having like the zest of something or fruit juice, or I did a homemade like ride flapjack with orange juice and zest in it to then create palate freshness. That's one way to do it. You can obviously then just have other counter flavors to go against it. You could try making rice cakes, which there are loads of recipes out there for rice cakes like that they use in the Peloton, but just use soy sauce in it instead, which creates a salty flavor for the same thing. That could work quite well.
Right, next one. Question from Ryan in Pennsylvania. I've raced in 2 gravel races so far this year, a 46 miler and a 40 miler a week apart. And in both races, I bonked at mile 30. I felt great at the start, held myself back from riding it even harder, but suddenly lost all leg strength 30 miles in. All I could do was spin my pedals in my easiest gear until the end. I'm reasonably fit at 38, run about 15 miles per week, but only have time to ride 2 to 4 hours a week after work or on the weekends. I hydrated the day before the race and ate normally oats, yogurt, fruit for breakfast about 2 hours before. Then during the 3-hour races, I ate bananas, applesauce, and 2 to 3 gels. I drank 300 ml of water an hour and 300 ml of electrolyte mix. Do you think the cause of consistent bonking is nutrition related, or am I just not getting enough saddle time and I need to adjust my expectations to a more realistic goal if I can't ride more?
On the surface of it, it seems like he's pretty clued up.
There's a lot of information here. He mentioned the main thing that I needed to know, which is that it was 3 hours long. He says he eats normally before the race, but he's doing an abnormal thing to his diet, which is to then go race 46 miles. So I would say that he should probably do a slightly higher carbohydrate diet the day before, reduce the fat a little bit to accommodate for calories, and help with muscle glycogen storage so he starts in a better state. And then he's getting up early to, did he say when he's...
Oats, yogurt, fruit for breakfast 2 hours before.
Okay, yeah. So yeah, a meal 2 to 4 hours beforehand. It doesn't say how many grams of carbohydrate that is, but I would say at minimum aim for 1.5 grams per kilogram body weight to 1.5 to 2.5 grams per kilogram body weight. So if he's a 70 kilo rider, that's going to be what, like 160 grams of carbs at the higher threshold there.
Is that a lot? What is 160 grams of carbs?
So that would be a slice of bread is around 25, like a standard thick slice.
Wow, so that is a lot then, isn't it?
So you have two of those and then you can have it with some honey on top and a banana. So a medium banana is around 25 as well. So that's 75 grams there.
Yeah.
Two slices of bread, a banana.
But it's double that then.
Yeah, but then you have a glass of fruit juice, 300 mils, that's 33 grams of carbs. So now we're at 110 or 115. We add some honey to the banana on the bread. Let's do a tablespoon of like 30 grams of that, which is like, I guess, like a big heap tablespoon, and that would be about 25 grams of carbs. So now we're at 140 grams. So it's only 20 grams left there, and that's not actually that much. It's essentially a banana sandwich with honey and a glass of fruit juice.
That really highlights how incorrect my breakfasts are for performance. Not that I'm not trying to perform, therefore it's fine, but from my racing days, I was doing it so bad. I was so off the mark. If that's the sort of correct breakfast that someone would be
could be one. I mean, I would, if you're going to have that, if you're having it 2 to 4 hours beforehand, I'd probably like to mix in just a little bit of fat and protein to slow down the digestion of that slightly. So that's quite a low fiber option overall. Mm-hmm. It's quite a high glycemic index option, which means it will digest quite fast. And if it's all high glycemic, you can, end up increasing carbohydrate oxidation during the ride, which we probably don't want to do too much, can be a negative thing.
So I think based on what you said, perhaps what Ryan should do is maybe do a training ride where he tries to do one of these longer rides,
yeah,
but maybe be a bit more specific about the food he eats the day before and what is actually in his breakfast quantity wise,
yeah,
and see if that makes a difference. And if it doesn't, it probably is down to training volumes.
Yeah, because he seems to be running a lot, but he's doing
not
2 to 4 hours.
As much, yeah.
So perhaps it's just, although the cardio kind of translates, I think that conditioning, if you're not conditioned to your bike, you're going to fatigue faster and therefore be using more energy
For sure, he'll be inefficient. And obviously riding also is more of a resistance-based cardio exercise, whereas running's not. So there is different fatigue points. That's definitely, that was going to be one of the things I was going to mention as well. So
yeah, sure.
good one. What else? Is he saying that he's having 300 mils of an electrolyte mix and a water mix an hour?
To do 600
mils an hour.
Yeah.
Okay.
I believe so.
I think I would probably say put some carbohydrate in your water anyway. His amount per hour seems quite low. So he's doing 3 hour race. He's having a banana, which we said was 25 grams, an apple, which was like maybe 20 grams. Or it's applesauce, sorry. I don't know how much applesauce he's having, but maybe... Isn't applesauce like from a jar as well?
Applesauce is, I've found out this off TikTok, applesauce is like a different thing in America. Applesauce in the UK is something that you put on pork. And applesauce in America is like a child's snack that is beloved by adults because it reminds them of the nostalgia of being children.
They provide
children.
It in like those little fruit.
It's a bit like kids. It's kids.
Okay.
It's baby food.
Yeah,
it's what we would call baby food.
Is it not essentially the same thing though? Just like apple puree.
Yeah, it's apple puree. Yeah, but it's not like the sort of stuff you're putting on pork.
I don't know how much carbohydrate it's going to bring though. 2 to 3 gels. Standard gels, what, 25 grams each? This kind of race, I'd be aiming for 90 grams an hour. So that would be 3 items an hour essentially, which I don't believe is happening here. He's got, if it's 3 gels, that's 1 gel an hour. And then he's having a banana and some applesauce. So that means if we count each one of those as one item, he's then done 3 items for 1 hour and the other ones he's only getting 1 item an hour. So I'd also say he's underfueling overall. I would say he could maximize his bottles to have a bit of carbohydrate in there. Mm. Even if he just makes it 30 grams in the drink of 600 mils, he would increase an extra item without having to carry something extra.
It's almost, you know, he's doing these 2 rides a week apart. You don't know what other training he's done around it. Maybe it was a fatiguing week for others. It's kind
stress.
Of hard to know. Stress,
life
exactly.
Stress and things like
lack
that.
Lack of sleep. Maybe you're fighting some sort of infection you didn't realize. There's other things that it could be as
there
well.
Are.
So you almost have to do more.
Do more.
As in do more tests. Do you know what I mean? If you think of it as an experiment, you need to do more tests.
Yeah. I think easy things for me is increase the carbohydrate day beforehand to do a little bit of a carb load, increase his breakfast to around 140 to 160 grams of carbohydrates 2 to 4 hours beforehand, have a little bit of protein and fat with it, and then increase his amount per hour to 90 grams an hour, and then to practice that 90 grams an hour. So go from what he's doing currently to 2 items an hour, then to 3 items an hour. And then that should consistently move him forwards to be able to achieve the amounts that I'm recommending. And if he's still having the issue, then it's related probably to fatigue and training volume.
That's all the questions we have time for. Thank you very much for coming and chatting to us, Will.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, guys.
Keep sending in your questions and stories and fun stuff to wildonespodcast@cavemedia.co.uk. That's all for this week. Thanks for listening. And thanks to Will for joining us. Tune in next week as we will have Francis back in the building. Please like and subscribe if you're watching on YouTube. Please follow and leave us a good review if you're listening. And we'll see you on the next one.
Oh, yeah. Thanks
Wait,
so
I've got one more question, Will, before we go.
Yes.
We've talked a lot about food for a purpose and performance. But in terms of just for the love of food, what's your favourite meal of all time?
My favourite meal of all time? Oh, pressure. To cook would be aglio e olio, which is a pasta dish with...
Sorry, say
those words again.
My favourite meal to cook is aglio e olio, which is a pasta dish. Which is with parsley, lemon, and lots of olive oil and garlic. It's really quick, really easy. Great dish to cook for a date as well.
Oh,
yeah, that's right.
That's why you've cooked it for me before. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Tune in later for After Dark with Will.
What else is my other?
What if you were going out? Is there any like this is my favorite meal from this specific restaurant or anything like that?
I really do love barbecue, American barbecue.
Nice.
Love Thai as well. Thai is a good choice. We're about to go for pizza though. I do like pizza.
We are about to go for pizza. Yes. Again, we are just plying you.
And let's also not forget, and ice cream.
Oh yeah, and ice cream, yeah. That's the important one though, right?
You're on your holidays basically up here,
yes,
aren't you?
Yes, exactly. So.
Okay, that was it, thanks.
Amazing.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.